It's better later than never. So I turned off. Well, I turned on the recording. So at least what follows you will be able to find on the internet. But so far we didn't do much. Okay. Anyway, the theorem that I'm going to prove can be formulated as follows. Over algebraically closed field, any operator in a finite dimensional space has an eigenvalue.
Chandra, Ravan Ford.
Hello, question? So let the dimension of this space be N. We have this operator T, and I claim that T has an eigenvalue. Let me remind that this statement doesn't hold true for operator over, say, reals. Example. Let us take an operator with matrix 0, negative 1, 1, 0. This is an operator in on the plane. Geometrically, this is a rotation by pi over 2. By right angle. And of course, it has no non-trivial eigen vectors, no eigenvalues. But here, this is an operator over reals, and reals are not algebraically closed. There is a polynomial x squared plus 1, which has no roots. Over complex numbers, it has. Okay. So let's go to proof of this. Take any non-zero vector from our space. Well, of course, this theorem is for operators in vector space which are not zero dimensional. In zero dimensional, we have only one operator and it has no eigenvalue. So this is an obvious exception. I had to say that n is not equal to zero from the very beginning in the statement of theorem to be accurate. And then we do the following. Take this vector, its image under T, the image of this image under T, so T squared of, t cube of v, and so on, up to t to power n of v. Overall, we have here n plus one vectors. And where they live, all of them are in V, and V has dimension n. So they must be linearly dependent. So there should be a polynomial. Well, not polynomial. Polynomials will appear in a moment. But right now, there is a linear dependence, which looks like that. A naught times V plus A1 times TV plus A2 times T squared V, and so on, plus AN times T to N V. And this is equal to zero for this specific V. And some of these coefficients is not zero. So what we see here in this equality and in the left-hand side is just a value of t at t of a polynomial p, where p is the polynomial a naught plus a1x plus etc. plus an x to power n, okay? And now it's time to use that our field is algebraically closed. This is the polynomial, a polynomial which is non-trivial and its degree greater than zero. Then it has a root. Here I will need to use some piece of algebra. You know, if some polynomial has a root, say lambda, so p of lambda equals zero, then this polynomial can be divided by x minus lambda. In this way, it is written usually that this polynomial divides that, like with numbers. And what this means? This means that p of x equals some p1 of x times x minus lambda. And p1 of x is again a polynomial, and we can apply this argument to it again if it is not constant. So we can continue, and this is p2 of x times x minus lambda prime, okay, lambda 1, x minus lambda, and so on. And doing this as long as we can, we come up after several steps to the situation when we have a constant. You know, each time the degree of this result of division of this pi decreases by one. And after that, we have something like that. P of x is factorized into linear terms. This is what really we need from the condition that it is algebraically closed. Of course, it is easier to formulate in terms of property of the field, but here we have a property of polynomial. Okay, now we can do the following. We can evaluate this polynomial at t, and it would look like that. P of t equals t minus lambda 1 I, t minus lambda 2 I, so on, t minus lambda n I. So we factorized our P of t operator as a composition of n operators. And we know that if we apply this P of t to V, we get zero. So we can apply P of t to V step by step. So V is not zero by assumption. We can apply to it first the one of these factors. What may happen? It may happen that after application of this first factor, we will get zero. Then V is an eigenvector and lambda n is eigenvalue and we are done. If not, if this is not zero, then we have not yet succeeded, but we can take V, the result of this application, denoted by V1, and look at the next factor. Next factor, would it kill it or not? So far it is not zero, but when we apply the next factor, it may become zero. And then we have found the eigenvector and eigenvalue. It may happen that it is not, and then we continue, and at the end, when we apply all of them, we must obtain zero. At what stage it will happen, we don't know. But it doesn't matter. Anyway, in whatever place it will happen, it gives the result. And that's it. So please look through this again and ask questions if you have. This is a good time to ask questions. Is everything?
So, yeah, so why do we have to obtain, or why does V something times this T minus lambda I have to equal zero?
Remember, we started with a vector which is not zero. And then we applied to it our operator n times. So we got in this way n plus one vectors. They must be linearly dependent in this space just because of dimension. And this linear dependence really looks like the operator applied to this vector. Polynomial evaluated at this operator applied to our vector. So the result is zero, we know this, by construction of this polynomial. We have constructed simultaneously with it, not only polynomial, we have constructed a vector which is non-zero and at which this P of t equals zero. And then this P of t splits into product of linear terms. And if we look what happens at multiplication, so we may take P of t of V. Oh, Lauda, I do not hear you.
So we used a fundamental theorem of algebra to show that each linear map has an eigenvector, right?
Yes. So I used this assumption that F is algebraically closed. Otherwise, I wouldn't get this decomposition of polynomial into linear factors. Okay, done? Some other questions? If we are done with this, let's go further. So, for various reasons, we will consider what is called upper triangular matrices. Upper triangular matrix looks like that. There is a diagonal of this matrix where some numbers may stay. And below this diagonal, we have only zeros. Above this diagonal, we have whatever. If there are also zeros, this is also upper triangular matrix, but it may deserve a name of diagonal matrix, if only diagonal is there. So in other words, upper triangular matrix is a creature like this, which looks like really a triangle of non-zeros and below which we have zeros. And for operator, in terms of operator, what this shape means, if T has a matrix of which is upper triangular, then this means that we have a basis. Matrix appears only when we have a basis. So we have a basis. And with respect to this basis, the operator behaves as follows. The image of a generic member of this sequence, Vi, or Vj, looks like that. It is a linear combination of these elements of the base, but in this linear, look, here I have to sum up over I from 1 to n. But when I sum up, well, the coefficients are taken from a column of this matrix. And in this column, after the diagonal element, I have nothing. I have zero. So this looks like that. The sum from 1 to j of Tij Vi. In other words, for upper triangular matrix, the image of the jth element of the basis belongs to a span of the first j vectors from our basis. So this is necessary and sufficient condition for being upper triangular, or representation, well, for the fact that matrix, or how it was defined, M of T with respect to this basis is upper triangular. This is so if and only if we have this property. Let us denote this span by V capital J. So we have a sequence of subspaces. V1, which is span of just V1, small. V2, span of V1 and V2, etc. Vj, etc. Vn, and this Vn is already the whole V. And this starts with a zero space. So this is an increasing sequence of subspaces. It is strictly increasing. At each stage, we have added one element of the base. The condition that I just wrote here, that the image of Vj is contained in the span in Vj. So this condition means that they are all invariant. So T of Vj is contained in Vj. Let me introduce a word which is not, which is missing in the textbook. A thing like that, a sequence of subspaces, which are increasing, the sequence is increasing, each next is containing the previous and is contained in the next one, is called a flag of subspaces. You may think about this as follows. So you have your hand, you have a stick, on the stick you have a flag and then the ambient space. So in the three-dimensional situation, you have just zero-dimensional, one-dimensional, line, plane, and they are increasing. So it is naturally to call flag. It is quite often appears here, and you will see that it is easier to deal with them than with individual vectors and bases. So we have less information, but all essential information is there. So again, an operator has in this basis upper triangular matrix if and only if there exists a flag of subspaces which are invariant with respect to this operator. So each of them is mapped to itself.
Wait, Professor, can you explain what a flag is again?
Explain what?
Flag.
Flag? You know, a thing like this. It is called flag, right?
Yes, but what does that have to do with vector spaces?
And now we live in a space, our space is V. And in this space, there is a zero dimensional subspace. Then there is V1, it's a line passing through this origin. Then there is a plane, V2, and finally there is an ambient space. Well, we live in three-dimensional space. If we had more dimensions, the story could be continued. But overall, we have... are you saying something?
I'm not saying anything right now. I'm just trying to understand. I still don't see what a flag, why are you calling it a flag?
Well, the definition, formal definition of flag is, this is a sequence of subspaces which is increasing. It starts with zero, and complete flag is when you do not miss any dimension.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Why is it called a flag?
Why what?
Why is it called a flag?
I don't know. I tried to explain this, but if you do not like this explanation, it doesn't matter. I mean that this is the name. vector space.
Okay.
Yeah, so it is just called a flag. The image is that this is an increasing sequence of subspaces. So you have subspaces here, all of the dimensions in this sequence, and you gradually add more. With any basis, you can associate a flag. Namely, if you have basis V1, V2, V3, and so on, vn, what you can do, you can take span of the first vector, just the space generated by this vector, a span of the first two vectors. It's a plane, two-dimensional space generated by them. Then you add the third vector and so on. So each time you add one base vector, so your space generated by them grows. And at the end, you get the whole space. Of course, the basis there is extra, brings extra information, the choice of vectors. But essential features of it is just in this sequence of spaces, as we will see. It is more convenient to operate with them. And in our situation, this is enriched by the operator, which preserves all these subspaces belonging to the flag. And now, theorem. Again, we are over an algebraically closed field. We have an operator in finite dimensional space, the vector space has dimension n, well, greater than zero, but finite. And that's it in the assumptions, conclusion. There exists a basis in which T is upper triangular. So we always can find in terms of subspaces, this means exactly that there exists this, a flag of invariant subspaces, a flag of subspaces invariant with respect to T. Is the statement clear?
Yeah.
If so, let me pass to the proof. In one dimensional space, there is nothing to prove. If dimension is one, then our matrix has just one element and it is upper triangle, it's automatically. Any non-zero vector is eigenvector. Now, assume that we have proven this for dimension, for all operators in spaces of dimension less than n. And now let us take an operator T in n-dimensional space. We know already that such operator has an eigenvalue and eigenvector. So there exists some vector, non-zero, such that T of U equals lambda U for some lambda. And this means that the span of this U, let me denote it by U capital, is invariant. Tell me please, why I write contained? T U is contained in U.
maps from U to U.
Yes, that's right. But why not equal?
It's not the same. It's not the identity map, but it's in the same subspace.
That's a problem, but not exactly. The problem may happen that T restricted to U is zero. Then T of U is zero. U is one dimensional. It is generated by non-zero vector. I said that T of U is contained in U, and this is just invariance of this U. So it may happen equal U, or may happen that it is zero. In both cases, it is correct. Now, what I can do with my operator, if I have such a subspace. First of all, I can consider its restriction to U.
What do we mean when T is invariant on U?
U is invariant on the T. This means exactly that inclusion, that T of U is contained in U. Okay. I can consider, therefore, operator from U to U, which maps whatever W from W from U to some element which belongs to the same U. It doesn't move it out.
So is it kind of like closure?
The word closure is used in many ways, in particular in this way. So this operator does not move me out of U. That's it. And also I can consider the quotient space. I can consider the quotient space of V, U by, of V by U. Let me remind that this is a set of cosets, like vector plus U, where V from V capital. They also form a space, vector space, and this is this space. And if U is one dimensional, then the quotient space is N minus one dimensional. So dimension of this N minus one. And this means that there is a sequence of subspaces of lag. In this quotient space, in the quotient space, which are invariant with respect to the operator. The operator is the quotient operator. Do you remember this? We studied this, not long, but it was at least defined and mentioned. So we have our operator T, if U is invariant with respect to it, generates also this operator in the quotient space. And by the assumption that in N minus one dimensional space, we have such a flag, we got this flag, and then I suggest to take preimage of it. So there is a map from V to the quotient space, say P, and I take P inverse of WJ. So this flag gives rise to flag of subspaces in V. I start here with zero, but the preimage of zero is U. So I get the following flag. One dimensional U, then P inverse of W1, then P inverse of W2, and so on. Totally N spaces. Well, maximal number, the whole flag. And it is invariant. And that's it. So we have proven this theorem. In the textbook, this theorem is proven twice. I think that each of the proofs is not far from this one, but much shorter, much longer. Here we have an advantage that our the advantage of the notion of the flag. When we have flag, we have a shorter argument. Yeah, again, we considered here only algebraically closed field. So in practice, for your environment, it is just C. R does not fit here. Neither Z2 or whatever finite field. There is no finite algebraically closed fields. But any field can be included into algebraically closed fields. It is quite a difficult construction in general. But I wouldn't dive into this. The theorem is correct under this assumption. Now, a few remarks after that. What is, first let us observe what is a determinant. Of an upper triangular matrix. So we have upper triangular matrix on diagonal, we have some numbers lambda 1, etc., lambda n. Underneath we have zeros and above something. And what is the determinant of that? Tell me, please.
Hmm? It's just going to be the product of the diagonal elements, maybe.
I gave him my phone number, and you know what he's doing? He's just spamming.
Yes, yeah, so this is just the product of those diagonal terms, and how it happens. Well, we know the formula for determinant. The determinant of matrix was proved to be the sum of products, each product depended on permutation. So we take, for each permutation, we take the following, how to show this. So let me draw this. So we have 1, 2, 3, etc. n, and then in each column, I choose one element, one term. And this is the sigma of this term, sigma of 1, this is sigma of 2, and so on. I mean the row in which we choose this element. So we have a product of terms. It is sort of a graph of this permutation. It should be multiplied by the sign. But look, now we have all the terms below diagonal zero. So if our permutation is not identical, there will be some terms below diagonal, which are involved. So the only term in this sum, which is not zero, is this one, where we multiply exactly the terms on diagonal. Oh, by the way, I had to be more serious. I had to count them from right to left, 1, 2, 3, n. Because identity would then be on this diagonal. And if this permutation is not identical, then Some terms will be below, but some terms will be above. Okay. And on diagonal, we have this lambdas, and that's it. Questions about that? Should I remind you something about this formula in more details?
Does induction work too, to prove determinant of triangular matrices?
Well, it would work, of course. Because what I can do, if you have this expansion over the column, or over the row, what you can do, you can take this matrix and expand it along the first column. What you get is lambda one times the next upper triangular matrix. And by induction assumption, the determinant of it is the product of terms on the diagonals, which are lambda two, et cetera, lambda n. Yes, so we assume that this formula is correct for matrices up to size n minus one and expand along the first column. In this first column, we have only one non-zero element, so it should be this one. So we have to cross out the corresponding row and column, and in what is left, we see again upper triangular matrix, and this is what we already assume to be correct. So, have we done this? Should we go further? Other questions? So, when upper triangular matrix is invertible, the answer is if and only if on the diagonal there is no zero. You can compare this with a proof that is given in the textbook. In the textbook, there was no determinant, there was no criterion of invertibility. You know, the matrix is invertible if, and I used here silently, that matrix is invertible if and only if the determinant is not zero. The determinant is this product, so it is not zero if and only if all factors are not zero. And if you do not have determinants, then it is a completely different story, and you have to do this a little bit longer. So here we benefit from the construction. So if we have upper triangular matrix, eigenvalues of it are exactly the diagonal entries. I have to remind you what is some criterion for eigenvalue. Lambda is an eigenvalue of T if T minus lambda I is not invertible. Now, this matrix is not invertible if and only if its determinant is zero. And the determinant of this matrix, change notations. Let me say about lambda naught, because usually variable in this characteristic polynomial, and this is a value of characteristic polynomial in lambda naught. So the characteristic polynomial is, let me remind, is this thing. It is a polynomial in lambda. So the lambda naught turns it into zero. This means that lambda naught is a root of this polynomial. So, so finally, the number element of our ground field is eigenvalue if and only if lambda naught is the root of characteristic polynomial. This statement holds true on the assumption that T is upper triangular. So here at first glance, it is a very nice statement. So what we should do if we want to find eigenvalues, just calculate a characteristic polynomial and find its roots. There are two problems here. First, calculate the characteristic polynomial. Of course, if T is upper triangular, this part is easy. Just take the product of terms on the diagonal. But in general, it is not that easy. If T is not upper triangular, you have to calculate this determinant. And second, okay, you got the polynomial, and then how to find all the roots. It's another algebraic problem, and you can do this. There are algorithms, but it is not an easy thing. However, here we are in a very nice environment. If our matrix is invertible, then both of these problems do not exist. You just see all the eigenvalues. And on the other hand, over algebraically closed field, any operator has the corresponding basis, and we can do this. We can find this sort of expansion. We can find, therefore, all these eigenvalues. Excuse me, at what time should I finish? I have still 7 minutes. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Then I have to introduce one more. Notion. So let's consider an arbitrary operator in finite dimensional vector space. Now it doesn't matter if it is over algebraically closed field or not, just over some field F. And consider the set of all eigenvalues, eigenvectors belonging to lambda. So we take lambda from this field and consider the space, the null space of T minus lambda I. this is a space. Of course, it contains a subspace of our space V. Of course, it contains zero as any subspace, and sometimes it is not called eigenvector, but we agreed to call it eigenvector. Anyway, this is the set of vectors in V such that Tu equals lambda U. Just a set of solutions of this. So it is denoted in this way, E lambda T, and it is called eigen space, which corresponds to this lambda. If lambda is not eigenvector, is not eigenvalue, then this is zero. It's interesting. I was suggested to stop my video, but I think that I can still continue. Okay, so this is a very nice space. First of all, it is invariant. It is invariant with respect to T, because each element is mapped to itself. So Tu equals lambda U. Lambda U is in the same space. Second, T in this space restricted to E of lambda T has the following matrix. It has a diagonal matrix with lambda on diagonal. So it is just lambda times I. So when we have the whole space made of those E lambda T, we sort of understand the whole operator. We know how it acts. It is very easy. So it is an ideal situation. We already know that this space is for eigenvalues. Have no intersections. Moreover, they form direct sum. There was a theorem that there is no non-trivial linear dependence between vector spaces, between eigenvectors correspondent to pairwise different eigenvalues. But the sum of all these subspaces is contained in V and maybe not coinciding with V. So when we have equality, then we say that this operator is diagonalized. Then there is a basis. If we choose basis in each of these spaces, with respect to this basis, we will have a picture like that. On some part of diagonal, we have lambda one, then lambda two, and so on, and zero around. And in the next lecture, we will consider a more general situation and understand what to do, how to classify operators in more general case. That's all for today. Thank you very much, and ask me questions.
So if the direct sum is V, does that mean V is diagonal?
It may happen. If it is V, then we say that this operator is diagonalized. It is then presented in this form. But quite often we have something else. And what else we can have, we will discuss next time. I hope that next time we will figure out.
In the beginning of the video, you said that an algebra is like the set of all operators over vector space, right? Is that the general definition, or is that just our definition for now?
No, this is an example of algebra.
Okay, all right.
There are many algebras, for, in particular, algebra of polynomials, or some subalgebra of algebra of operators in a vector space.
Okay, got it.
It's more general notion. But we used it, you see, we used algebra of polynomials and its homomorphism to algebra of operators to get some information about a specific operator.
Okay.
It is useful. It's a part of language. You see, such a general name. Algebraic structure is called with the same name as the whole subject of algebra. So it means that this happens often, at least in some situations. Other questions? Oh, then that's all for today. See you on Thursday. Okay. I cannot. Okay.